Docket is People versus Rogow, case number 2011-SC-597. Are both counsel ready? Our case is set for an hour, so half an hour per side, and petitioner will have to keep track of your time. All the housekeeping measures, I think both of you were in the courtroom before, heard about the iPad, and please state your name. We're ready to proceed.
Good afternoon, Kathy Gillespie, representing the people of the state of Colorado this afternoon. Registration number 26109. This issue comes up before the court on what essentially is the scope of the position of trust. And I think it goes a little bit back and talks about exactly when we look at the position of trust and what it encompasses. A defendant is in position of trust with respect to a child when he is invited into the child's home by a parent while that parent is at work. The defendant invites the child who is at that house to leave the premises with him in the truck, places him in the car, takes the child to two different locations, separates the child from a sibling, and sexually assaults the child once he is able to isolate that child away from their sibling. In this particular case, the Court of Appeals, I think, narrowed this definition too much and essentially looked at this case as it in a moment in time, saying that the defendant in this case, because the father did not give specific permission to him to supervise the child on this particular date and time, and didn't charge him with some sort of overt act to charge this particular person with taking care of his daughter, the Court of Appeals, at least two of the three, found that that was insufficient evidence. Judge Boris in the Court of Appeals, I think rightly so, pointed out two different points. One would be that if you look at the overall relationship between this particular defendant, the family, and his prior relationship with the children and the father in this case, I think there was enough evidence. Clearly, they convinced 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt that the position of trust existed.
How long did this rental arrangement work? How long? The defendant owned this place, right?
Correct. And the victim's father and the family stayed there. The defendant was the landlord.
Right.
And from the testimony that it was introduced at trial, they had been in that house for 2 years. They had had an ongoing relationship with the defendant that the father described as not a straightforward business relationship. That they took the rent checks over there in person, often went in and socialized with the defendant and his wife. The victim's two older brothers on numerous occasions had gone over and done chores for the defendant. One of those children, one of the boys, described that the defendant would teach him responsibility and the benefit of helping others. And the father considered this person a friend. In this particular case, the father had, it was summertime. So
access to the household beyond what a landlord would normally have, is that what you're saying? Some kind of relationship?
More of a family friend. Both the older brother that was with the child that was molested at the two different stores said that he trusted the defendant. The father said, you know, so the father calls the defendant, says he needs some work done on the shower. The kids are home for the summer, hanging out. The defendant comes over. Clearly the father was comfortable having him in the house with the kids there alone. Defendant comes over, needs parts to fix the shower, and invites these kids to get in the car with him and go with him on the errand. One boy stays behind and says that it was because there wasn't enough room in the truck, and the brother and the victim in this case go with him to the store. When they're at the store, the defendant's giving the kids directions about what he needs done, asks the older boy to go down the aisle in the store to look for something else, and that's when he gropes the little girl in the chest. The father testified that he absolutely would expect his children, if they were alone with the defendant, to follow his directions. And I think the fact that in this case, the defendant invited these kids to go with him, and when the father got home and the two kids were still with the defendant, he testified he wasn't concerned at all. The kids had been alone with the defendant before.
Can I ask you one thing to clarify there? Just before Justice Hobbs asked you that question, you were starting to make a sort of a sufficiency of the evidence, and then you're recounting the evidence. I noticed the dissenting opinion of the Court of Appeals did that too. You're not suggesting that the definition of a position of trust is one left to the jury at all, are you?
No, I think the definition, obviously, is a statutory interpretation, and so that's a de novo review.
And is that primarily what we're faced with here?
I don't think so. I think the definition by the plain language here clearly encompasses what we're talking about here. I think the way the Court of Appeals interpreted that definition makes it a question.
And I guess I'll take that as the answer. I guess the only point I was making, are we faced here with whether there was sufficient evidence taken in the light most favorable to the people, et cetera, to satisfy that definition? Or are we first and foremost primarily concerned with what is the definition of a position of trust and how broadly does that go? And certainly that's not a jury question, right?
Correct. And I think my position is that this court's already done that in Pellman and that the Court of Appeals incorrectly interpreted this court's definition, narrowed it down more than this court did, and found insufficient evidence. I think if the court sticks with its definition and its explanation in Pellman based on the statutory language, then I think it is a sufficiency of the evidence claim, and I think at that point the evidence needs to be reviewed in the light most favorable.
Ms. Gillespie, could you just run through the statutory language that you think covers the fact pattern here?
The position of trust is anybody who's been charged with the responsibilities of parental duties, either independently or through another person. The position of trust factors here, as I outlined in my brief, talk about the fact that the defendant had known this family for 2 years. The defendant lives close by. The victim's family called the defendant and his wife by their first names when they went over to pay rent. They were always invited into the defendant's house where they would converse and talk to the defendant and his wife. The father described the relationship as not typical of a landlord relationship in that it had not been strictly business. The two boys helped the defendant around the house with chores, and that the father was comfortable with the boys being alone with the defendant in the house. The father stated that the defendant had talked about wanting to teach the two boys responsibility and helping others. He had invited the little girl, well, it invited all three, but two of the children went with him to the store. So the defendant took them out of the home where the father clearly thought that they were and took them to two different stores. The children went with him, obviously, because of the relationship that they had with them. When the father came home from work the day of the assault and learned that the two children were with the defendant, he wasn't concerned. He had previously taken the boys on errands alone, and from that statement, it can, you know, reasonable inferences that he considered him to be supervising the children when they were alone with him. The father felt that during the time that the two kids were with the defendant alone, he was 100% responsible for them. And the father testified that if the defendant told the kids to do anything, the father would expect them, the children, to obey what the defendant had said.
Could I stop? I'm over here. I can stop you for just a moment. A lot of that recitation deals with the relationship with the two older siblings.
Mm-hmm.
What about the victim specifically? And I'm thinking about statutory language. It talks about the actor being in a position of trust with respect to the victim. How do we translate that? Or are you saying, given the overall familial relationship, we can draw inferences that position of trust thereby extended to the victim? I'm just trying to understand the nature of your argument.
That's it. I think there are other factors as we get into the act itself that is direct evidence of the position of trust, but I think that it can be a reasonable inference from the overall relationship that the defendant had with the family, and the fact that the father clearly, you know, there's ample evidence that the position of trust and that type of relationship and how the father viewed the defendant in relation to the three children, I think you can draw reasonable inferences that if he trusted them with the two boys and educated them and was trying to teach them responsibility and things like that, that when you take that overall relationship into consideration, in addition to the facts in this case where he removed the little girl from the home, to go on it and stated to the father that he, when the father confronted him about sexually assaulting the little girl, the father testified that the defendant stated that he had educated her and it was his little girl, that inside the store, the little girl did what the defendant told her to do. And when the defendant separated the older boy from the little girl and left the little girl in the car with the defendant while the older boy went into the second store, it just, I think inferences can be drawn from that overall relationship, kind of like in Pellman, where there's an overriding relationship, and during that relationship, the defendant is taking advantage of his ability to isolate her. But for the fact that this was a family friend that the little girl knew and was familiar with and who had been in these situations before, that's why she got into the car with him and left.
And so I guess I'm sort of reflecting back on the chief's question, in terms of the specific statutory language that you're relying on, I'm sensing that your argument is not necessarily directly tethered to language in the statutory definition of position of trust, but more this court's interpretation of that definition in Pellman, and looking at kind of the overall nature of the relationship and the access that the defendant had to the child as a result of that relationship. And that's really the core of your argument. In other words, our prior decision in Pellman kind of covers this set of facts as well.
It does, but I think that's also in the statutory language itself. It says, the position of trust includes but is not limited to any person who is a parent or acting in the place of a parent who has assumed the responsibilities of the parent's duties, rights, or a person who is charged with any duty or responsibility, and I'm skipping education, welfare, but supervision of a child, either independently or through another. And I think there are two sets of facts that fill that definition. One is the specific direct evidence of the position of trust that this particular man held with the victim herself. And then I think there's also circumstantial evidence that can be inferred from the fact that he had that same relationship with the two boys.
So to the extent you're relying on this person being charged with particular duties, are you looking to his voluntary assumption? I mean, he charged himself with those duties by inviting the children out to go with him on this errand, or are you sort of relying on Judge Boris's alternate theory that maybe the older child charged him with those duties, or are you suggesting, actually, what I'm looking at is the but not limited to language of the statute, meaning that it can encompass other situations?
Mm-hmm. And I think both would fit under that language, saying that it's not limited to where somebody is specifically charged with.
Okay.
I think the fact that he was a family friend, that the father allowed him into the house, I think he was charged with, based on the nature of their relationship, there was an assumption by the father that if the defendant was alone with the children, he was supervising them, especially when he removed the child from the home and took her to a different location. I think it's like in Pellman, it's a family friend that overall, because of the relationship between the defendant and the family, there was a understanding or a position of trust that if the defendant was with the children and the little girl needed something or needed to be supervised, that the defendant was going to do that.
So in fact, you're not actually relying directly on Judge Boris's alternate theory that the older boy may have transferred that charge of trust by leaving the defendant alone with the girl in the truck, for example.
I think that's another alternative way to look at it. I see it at all as inferences that can be drawn from the evidence to establish the position of trust. Not only did the father feel comfortable enough and have this close relationship with the defendant, but clearly the children saw him that way too. Since the older boy gets out of the car, does what the defendant says, leaves the daughter there, I don't think you necessarily have to point to a specific time and place where the parent, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals is asking us to do, is there doesn't need to be any point in time where the parent points the finger and says, I am charging you with responsibility of supervising my little girl whenever you're alone with her, as long as we're friends. I think it is something that can be inferred, and reasonable inferences that the jury can draw from the evidence that was presented based on the overall relationship and the specifics between the defendant and the little girl.
Was that argument made or was the jury instructed along those lines that you just presented? Was the jury instructed along those lines or did prosecution make that basic, it's just the overall relationship argument? I'm just trying to understand how the jury understood.
In the closing argument, I think when the DA was talking about the position of trust, they were talking about the overall relationship. As far as the actual charge to the jury, it was this specific definition, which when I read one in a position of trust includes but is not limited to any person. It's just a question of whether it's direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
I'd like to pursue that just a little. I'm still having the feeling a little bit that your argument is, well, given all the facts and circumstances in Pellman, and that constitute a position of trust, and this looks a lot like that, so this should too, but that doesn't help me a great deal in deciding what it is about this that makes it a position of trust and how we would define this term for future cases. Are you suggesting whether it was a specific grant of power by the parent or not, that it's a question of whether the parent trusted the person or whether the children trusted the person? Or whether the person thought he was acting as a parent? At the end, I thought you were suggesting, as I thought the dissenting opinion did, that a 14-year-old could make someone a position of trust simply by allowing them to be alone with the child. Where would we end that?
I think it is all... My position is that it's not a specific moment in time when that is taken over, that it's the overall position of trust relationship going to, based on what this court pointed out, the people that we're trying to target or what the position of trust is intended to target are these defendants that have access to their victims because of this trusted relationship. Because of that relationship, they're then able to...
Trusted from the parent? That the parent trusted them with? Or I thought when you got... I was talking about the brothers and the girl, that it was whether they trusted the person. Are we looking just if they're in the position, if they're in proximity to someone they trust? Is that the issue?
No, I think we're looking at, from the statute, any person who is a parent or acting in the place of a parent for the general supervision of the child's welfare. I mean, the definition itself doesn't say that the parent has to grant that.
So is someone who's fixing the sink acting as a parent?
No, I think if this had been a typical landlord relationship and the gentleman had gone over and there had been no friendly relationship, like in this case, if it had been a typical landlord and he was called and he went into the house to fix the sink and ask one of the children to leave with him, no, then I don't think that would be.
I've always been interested in the use of the word trust because it seems to me it's got to look at the obligations that a person in this defendant's position undertook when he relates to an underage child. You owe a duty to not commit a violation of the law against them, a sexual assault in this case. So it's not only what trust it seems to me the family might have placed in this guy, what access, it's the duties he owes to these underage children when he takes them out of the house and is in a situation where he can either give in to some sort of an instinct and commit a crime or avoid that because he owes them a trust responsibility. So I'm questioning whether or not, the legislative definition isn't both sides of the equation, and that the judge really has to decide whether to let this charge go to the jury, which this judge obviously did, mm-hmm. based on, I assume, sufficient evidence to give an instruction that this person was acting in a position of trust, right? It's not totally just left up to the jury. The judge is assessing it, right?
I think obviously there has to be, some evidence there to support the finding of a position of trust based on the language of the definition itself. And I think those, trying to think of situations like I just explained to Justice Coates about where that line would be. And I think when you read the definition of a position of trust, it assumes that there is this grant of authority to this particular person.
Or an assumption of authority under the circumstances.
I'm sorry?
Or the assumption of authority under circumstances. There might even be an implied consent here.
Correct.
The parents have allowed this person to have access. My point is,
you know, coaches, teachers, counselors, I mean, people that have a responsibility to treat the child correctly but have abused the child.
Correct, and not in every situation do I drop my child off at school and walk in and say, just so we're clear, I'm placing you in a position of trust with my daughter. As by the nature of that relationship, teacher, coach, pastor, therapist.
Person with access to your kids who are vulnerable in your absence.
Correct, and I think if it is a, if it's a job or a position that we all just automatically assume is a position of trust, like the teacher and the coaches and things like that, that's why I don't think it's necessarily this grant of authority that has to come out of the parent's mouth. And that's why I think in this case, the Court of Appeals was too narrow. They were looking at, well, the father didn't give him permission to go in and take the children out of the house this day. No, but he was a trusted family friend. If that had been an uncle going over there to do something on the house and taking them out, we wouldn't be even having this conversation that that was a position of trust. So I think my point is Pellman is correct in looking at when you are trying to look at whether or not facts fit this statutory definition. There is nothing about this particular definition. There's no language in here that limits that to a specific moment in time, other than that it has to exist at the time of the unlawful act. And I think here, due to the overall nature of the relationship, and looking at the relationship is where I bring in the comfort level of the boys and how all of these people interacted, because of course now the defendant's saying, I didn't have that kind of relationship with him at all. I walked in to fix his shower and simply asked somebody to go to the store with me. Well, that's not what came out at trial, and that's not the evidence that was produced as far as what this overall relationship was between this defendant and this child. And I think all of that that came in is relevant evidence to whether or not this position of trust existed. And I think from the father's testimony and from a lot of the language the defendant said during the conversation with this little girl, that he was educating her and it was his little girl, that the father considered him a trusted friend, that the boy considered him a trusted friend.
Ms. Leslie, could I ask you to address Mr. Willett's argument? You're focused on the outline, the time and so forth. But he argues, as I understand it at least, that position of trust requires it statutorily, especially to distinguish it from other kinds of just plain old sexual assault, a special relationship, and that's the purpose. So I wonder how you could, if you would address that.
Well, I think what they're doing, the special relationship here, again, is the overall nature of the friendship between this trusted adult and this family and the way this family interacted with this particular gentleman. I think what they're trying to say is that because the father didn't come right out and ask this defendant to babysit or didn't ask him to take the children to the store, therefore there was no position of trust because he had not been specifically charged with supervising him, supervising her. And I don't think that this, well, based on Pellman, that's not required. And also based on the plain language of the statute, it's not required. It says that the position of trust can be charged either independently or through another. And so I think what they're trying to do is narrow down the scope, as the Court of Appeals did, requiring this magic conversation to take place before this position of trust exists. And I think Justice Hobbs' point is a good one in that there are certain relationships based on the nature of the relationship that are a position of trust that don't require that type of conversation because it's assumed.
Well, that would apply, you know, that's certainly accurate. We obviously have responsibilities to children. But when you define a statute and make a harsher penalty and use a term like position of trust, that automatically, at least in generally, I think, in thinking about it, you're talking about a coach, educator, and so forth. Teacher, and there should be some distinction between a class 4 sexual assault.
Absolutely.
And Pellman had some unusual facts in it.
It did.
So,
and I think here the overriding concern, as this court pointed out in Pellman, was this statute is intended to target those defendants that are able to manipulate, lure, and isolate their victim because of that relationship that they have with the child. If this had been the general handyman that just came down into the apartment complex to fix the shower, the children never would have gone with him. It was the nature of the relationship that allowed him to not only lure that little girl out of her house.
Well, wait a second. I could argue, I mean, just thinking about it, a handyman comes in and says, hey, guys, let's go down and get some ice cream. Hey, let's do it.
But that's not because of his position of trust.
That's right.
This was because of his position of trust. This was because of his relationship with his family that these children willingly went with him. And based on the overall nature, it was a safe place to go. He was a trusted adult in their life. And because of that position of trust, that friendship he had with the family, he should be held to the higher level felony because he manipulated that relationship in order to sexually assault her.
You seem to be, part of what I'm concerned about here is it seems like there are very many things that in your view were necessary for this to be a position of trust. And it might be hard to duplicate those situations or talk about exactly which one was necessary, which one wasn't. Let me go to the other extreme. Do you mean to be saying then, by relying on all of these things, that you do not think it would be enough for a position of trust if the father had invited into the house a workman of some kind, knowing that he was allowing that workman to be alone with his children while he was gone? Would that be enough? Would that be an implicit?
Mm-mm.
No.
I don't think so. I think that the statute's looking more for that position of trust. When you look at the definition, they're talking about a relationship between the defendant and the victim.
Children or the parent?
The victim. Between the defendant and the victim. And that relationship is given access by a parent, usually, whether it's a school or a coach or a uncle or a friend or a boyfriend. But it's a relationship with them, and it's that trusted, they've been entrusted with.
But you seem to be saying it's not a question of them being entrusted. It's rather a question of the victim trusting them because of the relationship.
No, I think they're entrusted by the relationship with the father. The father is entrusting because of this close relationship and because of the access that he had to these kids and his allowing the defendant to come into the house while they were gone, not being alarmed, not even being concerned when he comes home and finds out the two kids are alone with him. That overall relationship showed that he had entrusted this particular man with the care of his children when he wasn't there. And that he assumed, because of the nature of their relationship, that those kids would have done what the defendant said when they were out and about in town. And so I don't think you can narrow it down to one particular factor. In this case, you know, the question is, did there have to be, according to the Court of Appeals, and what we're arguing is, did there have to be a specific conversation entrusting that responsibility?
And fine, suppose we go that there doesn't have to be, it can be implicit. Mm-hmm. But you're still saying it's the entrusted by the parent that is the important part, or is an essential part? And now we've said before that the defendant can assume the position of trust, right? So that would seem to mean it's not just a question of the parent entrusting that person.
No, and when I say entrusting, I'm talking about in a situation like this one. But I think it's that relationship. I think if, let's say, you know, I don't know, a coach, let's say a kid's participating at a school and going to a sporting event, and maybe the parents don't even know about it. But because of that position that the coach is in relation to the child and the overall relationship between those two and how they are interacting with each other and in what type of situations, there's a position of trust there. Whether the parent knew that they were going out with the coach, because of that coach's responsibility, which I don't think the general handyman necessarily has. I mean, I'd like to say that every adult has a, you know, duty to supervise.
That seems to be an example of a formal relationship rather than one that's actually personal.
Which one? The
when
coach?
You say a coach, mm-hmm. someone, it's because of the formal relationship with the trainee, the trainer and the trainee, or whatever it is, the coach and the athlete.
Correct.
Even if there's not a personal trust relationship, either between the victim and the defendant or the parent and the defendant.
And I think that's why this language is as broad as it is because there are many different ways that position of trust and that responsibility can link between that adult and the child. And if they are responsible for some of the supervisory or the welfare or any of the other factors that they list in the statute, that can come about in different ways. And I think that's why it was written so broadly, was because I don't think you can narrow it down to a conversation between a parent and an adult. You know, it's the position of trust is under 18. There are a lot of 16-year-old, 17-year-old kids out there that have relationships with adults that their parents may or may not know anything about. And I think the reason why it is listed as one in a position of trust includes, but it is not limited to, is because the target is those defendants that commit those sexual assaults by violating that relationship between the child and the defendant themselves. And that's how they lure these kids away.
And that comes about either by virtue of an actual personal relationship, as you would say in this case, or by virtue of a formal relationship, teacher, student, pastor, Sunday school student, something like that. Even if that trusting, I mean, I'm thinking of day one in a classroom, brand new teacher, that kid has no relationship whatsoever in a personal sense with that teacher, but that teacher still has that formal responsibility by virtue of the formal relationship. And you're saying that this covers both categories.
I think it does. And I think, you know, the first part is, but it's not limited to any person who's a parent or acting as a parent, and talks about the general supervision and the responsibility for the child's welfare, or a person who is charged with any duty or responsibility for health, education, welfare. And I think, you know, there could be an argument that by being a teacher, you are charged with the responsibility of your students' welfare, education, supervision when they're with you. So I think it's broad enough to include these personal relationships and then also these very set categories that seem to be obvious to most of us, the teacher, the clergy, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Unless there's more questions, I think your time's up.
Thank you.
Mr. Willett, we'll give you an extra minute.
May it please the court, Jonathan Willett, number 16264, for the respondent. I guess I want to begin by just addressing some of the comments of the petitioner here. And my sense is that they're all over the map. They petitioned this court on an issue that involves the legal interpretation of the statute. And then the people come in here and talk all about the facts, like it's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. But that's not the issue that's before the court. It involves a legal discussion, a de novo review of what the legal standard is for a position of trust. And I think all adults stand in a general position of trust regarding children. If I'm taking my kid to school, and I see another child crossing the street in a red light, I'm gonna say, whoa, stop. I'm in a position of trust generally with regard to children because I'm an adult in their midst and children do stupid things and need supervision. That does not necessarily, the generic term position of trust is not what the statute implies. You know, I think as citizens, we all sometimes wonder, what the heck is the legislature doing as citizens? But as lawyers and judges, we have to assume the legislature knows what they're doing.
What the legislature mean by that, not limited to language under your what the statute provides?
I think they were creating essentially things that could stand as analogous to a position of trust. They talk about a guardian, they talk about a babysitter, they talk about a doctor, they talk about people who stand in a special position concerning the welfare of children. They're not talking about the guy who runs a pizza shop, who the parent says, yeah, go hang out at the pizza shop after school. That's cool, I feel you're safe there. They're not talking about that guy. They're not talking about the school crossing guard, who's even there every day. And the children have to trust that he's gonna allow them only to cross when it's safe. It's not a general trusting relationship. The legislature meant to create a special relationship like they do in a lot of circumstances. They create special relationships between attorneys and their clients. They create special relationships between doctors and their patients. Here they meant to create a special relationship. And how do you know that? Because you must construe statutes in pari materia. And when I say that, essentially all adults stand in a position of trust. That's the class four felony. All adults abuse that position of trust when they sexually assault children. But here, they created a higher level of felony for the person who has a special position regarding the child. If you're not going to construe those two statutes together, then you're blurring the distinction between them, because the legislature specifically intended a distinction. There are some other points factually, and I think the petitioner was asked, well, tell us about that point in the statute that you're referring to here by the Chief Justice. And rather than recite any portion of the statute, the petitioner went back to the factual sufficiency of the evidence argument. And essentially, that's because the statute doesn't address necessarily the family friend or the handyman or the person who has a relationship with the family and the children but isn't a special relationship. It doesn't create the analogies that suggest that the interpretation that people want to give is the correct one.
Can I just ask you to repeat that? I guess your position as a family friend could never be a person in a position of trust?
No, definitely not. That isn't our position.
I guess I'm wondering, what's the difference between a family friend who has cultivated a relationship and has assumed some supervisory responsibilities and your special relationship category?
I think where Your Honor is going to there has to do with the interpretation from this court's decision in Pellman. And in Pellman, we had a person who was a family friend, but what the court said that's so critical is that there's got to be an ongoing supervisory relationship. The relationship in Pellman where a person assumes a position of trust, like a family friend, comes from the temporal, the time that family friend has been engaged in some kind of special relationship with the child, where he's had an ongoing and continuing supervision over the child. And I think what I'd like to allude the court to is where the Court of Appeals quotes Pellman. And the Court of Appeals quotes Pellman, and that's why we're saying they didn't decide anything wrongly. They say, in circumstance where a person has assumed a continuous and ongoing supervisory role in relation to the child, that person need not be charged with a supervisory task at the time of the unlawful act in order to be in a position of trust. So you might have a family friend.
Well, while you're drinking, let me just follow up on that. And that's where I think the confusion comes in with your particular argument. What I hope you will address is, when are you saying a special relationship is the equivalent to that continuous supervisory relationship?
Well,
you're coming up with a term, special relationship, so that's why I'm pressing you on that.
A special relationship comes out of an ongoing supervisory relationship over the general welfare of the child. And for instance, I'll use the facts in Pellman. In Pellman, you have a person who was a Sunday school teacher who also was a family friend who had previously cared for the children. Hence, he became not just an acquaintance, not just a person who has a general, someone whom children should obey, but someone who sort of transitioned to this higher level of relationship due to the ongoing and temporal length of his relationship, he had been a Sunday school teacher, critical word, teacher, and then also had cared for the children in the past. Here, and take issue a little bit with the people's recitation of the facts, there's no evidence that the defendant had ever cared for AB in the past. There's no evidence that the defendant ever had any kind of ongoing supervisory role with AB. On the contrary, as Justice Marquez pointed out, the defendant had employed the two older brothers in the past. There's no special relationship with the victim. There's no ongoing relationship with AB. So that had never transitioned to a point with AB where he voluntarily or otherwise assumed this special position of trust regarding AB's welfare. It would be as if, say, my child is at soccer practice, and I said to her, take the bus home. And she says, well, Mrs. Smith offered me a ride home. Is Mrs. Smith in a position of trust because one time she offered to give my child a ride home? One time? Because that's all the evidence there is. It's a one-shot deal here. It's the one time there's only evidence of one time did he give a ride for the child. Only one time was he with the child as an adult in a special way. And I think it's important, in a way, I think it's important to understand that the relationship between the defendant and this family was a business relationship. He was their landlord. Sure, he was friendly. But are you going to impose a special position of trust on every adult who's friendly? That seems to me to be...
Well, you know, that's not, you know, the wording we were interpreting in Pellman's was, quote, a person who is charged with any duty or responsibility for the supervision of a child. And then we go on and say, indeed, any such responsibility, no matter how brief,
yes,
will qualify. Now, the facts, as I understand them, is this went beyond your normal landlord situation where you just pay rent and have them come in for repairs. There was visiting back and forth. There was over 2 years, there was some kind of situation where this person did cultivate the trust of the parents as well as the kids. Now he removes these children from the home.
I understand.
Right? He removed, he is charged with, it's an interesting word to me. Who charges with this? The statute, the responsibility that comes from under assuming supervision yourself. It can't be limited to what the Court of Appeals says. I give you permission to take this child out of the home. You know, normally with young children, you arrange to be there when someone comes in the house who you don't know, right?
Indeed.
You don't just let the plumber in or anybody else you don't know.
Right.
Right. Well, that you're posturing those kinds of circumstances, right? So what is the term is charged with any duty or responsibility, no matter how brief, mean in the statutory language?
And I think the two observations I would make about the court's comments, which are obviously legitimate concerns, is that the position of trust must exist before the brief period occurs in which the alleged act occurs. I mean, there's got to be some assumption that's special before the act occurs. And then the second thing I'd point out is that there's really a dearth of evidence that AB was ever over there. There's a dearth of, there's no evidence, because essentially Mr. Baca, the father, would say whenever we would pay the rent, he'd invite us in. What does we mean? Does that mean him? Does that mean he sent AB over with a check? There's no evidence of that. Plus, there's no evidence of social intermingling aside from the exchange of pleasantries. What Mr. Baca said is that most landlords are strictly business. This guy was friendly. There isn't an evidence of, say, they're coming over for dinner. There's no evidence of Mr. Baca ever inviting him over to dinner, the defendant. So the contours of the what the people are characterizing as a friendship are really not there. What we're dealing with is a friendly landlord, which is different than a friendship. And we're suggesting that the evidence is lacking and was lacking all along on the existence of a detailed friendship. We're talking about a friendly person, which is different. I would suggest to the court that that the position of trust involves essentially a mild element of a fiduciary role. It's not necessarily a full fiduciary relationship, but a mild element of some fiduciariness in which someone violates that trust. It's a special kind of relationship. It's not a general relationship. And I think here, the evidence was really lacking on that. The people seem to suggest that the defendant intentionally separated AB. And that's contradicted by the record, I think, because he asked, who wants to go to the store? He didn't say, AB, let's go. He didn't say, why don't you come with me? Then the other thing that I think is important is that there are two brothers there. There's one older brother and one older brother. And it was the older brother who was kind of in charge. And even though the older brother, I guess, silently assented to this occurring, there's no evidence that the older brother said, take good care of my younger sister, or anything like that. There are no details to his discussion before the defendant gave the kids a ride to the store. All adults are responsible for children. And I don't think that that can be converted into a position of trust. It seems inappropriate to convert a position of trust to people who are cordial, people who are friendly. And to point out Justice Eade's concern about, well, can't a family friend assume a position of trust? Well, he sure can. But he's got to have shown some supervisory role in the past. According to this court's own interpretation in Pellman, there's got to be a length of time, and there's got to be some quality to the relationship that shows he was supervising the general welfare of the children. Food, shelter, calling the hospital if they're sick, something like that. And certainly any person can assume that position of trust, but if it doesn't have a continuous period of time, it's not what Pellman said, not what this court said. Paul Baca, the child's father, I think summed it all up in a way. He said, all children are expected to obey adults. The respondent agrees with that. The respondent agrees that a position of trust can be assumed. But it's true all children should be expected to obey adults. Does that mean all children who encounter adults, that the adults have created a position of trust? Suppose there's the public bus driver who the child sees every day. Does that mean because that adult is entrusted with the responsibility to safely get that child home, that he has a position of trust according to the statute? Not according to the statute he does, according to morality he does.
Could I back you up just one second. When you made the rather broad statement about all children should, whatever you said, be respectful and pay attention to adults. Actually, that may be a little too broad, because don't we all reasonably teach our children not to obey adults in certain situations, not to be near them, not to do what they say? And so is there something about the relationship, and I assume you would feel this is too broad, but since we have this language, but it's not limited to, it's kind of like a really broad statute that seems to indicate something like these situations we described. And could that be trying to get at simply an adult or some person who is in relation to the child at the time of the assault, such that the child would reasonably feel he should obey that person rather than obey them only out of fear or reward or being lured?
Well, I think the court's point is a good one, but I think there's a distinction between when we teach our child not to trust adults who engage in kind of luring behavior, like, hey, I've got some candy, come into my van.
Or strangers.
Strangers who say that, or even friends who say that. Why don't you, I've got a nice toy inside, why don't you come inside and play? That doesn't create a position of trust. I think that...
Would we say there that there was no relationship between those two such that the child should reasonably feel that he should obey the child? I mean, the adult or the person.
Well, I mean, suppose I'm a neighbor. I'm a friendly neighbor. I live near the child. Mm-hmm. And I say, I just got my child this cool new electric car. Why don't you come in and play with it? Because I'm a neighbor? Did that create the special relationship the legislature intended? That's a luring thing. That's a thing where an adult is morally violating his obligation to allow children to trust an adult. And I think, you know, we're in a world, obviously, where we have a lot of things that are disconcerting as parents. There are abductions, there are things we fear, but also we are part of communities where we trust other people in the community to act as responsible adults. But that doesn't elevate them to the position of things like guardians, things like stepfathers, things like babysitters. It says that, okay, we got a sense of community here. We're in a cul-de-sac where everyone knows one another, but the person across the cul-de-sac doesn't have a position of trust as the legislature intended. It's got a moral position of trust, which is more generic. And the two terms should not be confused. The legislature's term is a term of art, a special term.
Does that change at all your scenario if the parent, if kid says, hey, neighbor wants me to come over and play with this new toy, and mom says, that's fine? What difference does it make if the parent grants permission under your scenario?
It makes a lot of permission, because then you're engaging in the specific accord of a position of trust by the parent.
Then that meets the charging, no matter how brief language.
It's, in other words, it's like saying, and I think there's a case just like that where, I'm not sure if it was Madrill, but one of the cases cited in my brief, it was a one-time sleepover. One-time sleepover. There you go, one-time sleepover. That's a one-time deal where the parent's like, yeah, my child can stay over there tonight. So there is an element of a position of trust where the parent sort of accords permission, but that's distinct from the instant case where someone, and as we all agree, the issue is voluntary assumption of a position of trust. It's a distinct situation where, say, a parent lets the child go on, say, to a day camp with a counselor.
Right, and I guess where I'm struggling with that is, you know, if Dad had happened to be on site, I don't think there's any reason to think that Dad would not have granted permission in this particular instance.
Well,
given the nature, given the kind of history of the relationship. So I'm wrestling a little bit with a fairly casual relationship, but I grant permission as a parent for some very, very brief of time, and then that fits within the statute, versus I have a long-standing relationship with a neighbor. I happen not to be present when the neighbor assumes responsibility, however brief, for that child.
Right.
And that situation, even though there's a longer relationship there, would not fall in the position of trust.
Right, but I think what you, to answer your question, I would allude, Your Honor, to the scope of the facts in this case. What was accorded to the defendant? What was accorded to the defendant was permission to fix the shower. That's what was accorded. It wasn't, oh, fix the shower and look after my kids. It was, and essentially the father said, come by and fix the shower. He didn't say, come by and fix the shower, and by the way, my kids are there, I'd like you to maybe help the older brother, the oldest brother, because I'm concerned that he's only 16 and he may not.
So you really do want us to rule out the assumption of supervision?
I don't want you to rule it out. I think the specific issue that the petitioner presented was, did the Court of Appeals require a specific accord by the parent of permission? That's what they petitioned. That's what they said.
Well, what did the Court of Appeals hold?
I'm sorry.
What did the Court of Appeals hold on that regard?
I believe the Court of Appeals looked to the language of Pellman in light of the facts to see if there was a continuous and ongoing assumption of supervision over the child, and found that that part of the evidence was lacking, even in a light most favorable to people. That's what I think they did. They cited Pellman. They said there isn't an ongoing and assumption of this responsibility. And so in our view, the Court of Appeals did cite the applicable law, and the petitioner has petitioned this court to say, well, they didn't follow the law, but they did cite the law. And then they found that, well, the facts don't fit the law. This is a one-time deal, and there isn't any ongoing supervision. And this is just a landlord, or akin to something like just a neighbor. It could be someone the child knows. Not everyone the child knows meets that definition, that special definition, that term of art, position of trust.
Mr. Willett, and if I'm over here.
Oh, yes.
Good
sir.
Afternoon. In Madrill, it was a one night overnight, right? And
yes,
they
sir.
Found sufficiency, that was sufficient. Can you distinguish, other than the fact that it's a sleepover, did not the defendant, by assuming control of the children and taking them into a car, taking them someplace, just help distinguish that from Madrill for me, if you would, please.
Well, in an overnight, first of all, the permission was specifically accorded. So the parents said, yeah, have your sleepover. And in an overnight visit, you're supplying food, you're supplying shelter, you're saying if the child wakes up with a nightmare and screams, you're going to go over there and comfort the child. It's kind of like you're sitting in a parent's role at that time. And that is a distinction from giving a child a ride somewhere that could be 20 minutes long.
But he took him to the store. I mean, did the defendant not have an obligation to make sure they didn't crawl up the shelves and, you know,
yeah,
engage in hazardous behavior to make sure that they got home safely, you know, all of those things?
Well, I think the defendant had an obligation to make sure that the children arrived safely, were driven safely in the car, just like the mom gives the child the one ride home from soccer practice. The adult had an obligation to make sure the kids weren't climbing the shelves, and I think any adult in that aisle would have that obligation. mean, if you're in Home Depot and you're going down an aisle and you see a little baby or a six-year-old climbing up to reach an item, your moral obligation is to say, hey, I'm not your parent, but come on down. You're putting yourself at risk. And that's where I think we can draw the distinction between this case and Madrill, where you have a general moral obligation to look out for children if you're a responsible parent and or a responsible adult, and which is different than giving a child a ride and having sort of a casual, brief relationship with the child, which involves, say, driving them somewhere. Now, it would be totally different, Your Honor, if he always drove the children somewhere, if he took the children to school, if he took them home from school. Those things would be very different.
Mr. Willett, if Mr. Bacchus said, pick up the phone and said, you know, I'd like you to fix this apartment. I know you got to go, but I don't have the right parts. Will you take my daughter with you? Would that satisfy the statute?
Exactly.
One-shot deal?
I think so.
And that's why?
Well, why it is because the dad is giving them specific permission.
So what's the difference if there isn't specific permission given, but that the dad, not the dad, the handyman assumes supervision?
Well, I think it goes because the court interpreted, I think what you're dealing with there is a construction of Pellman.
Well, wait a minute. Pellman dealt with a long-term relationship,
right,
as you've pointed out many times.
Right.
So we don't have any of that. We're talking about one-shot deals.
Right. So you have a one-shot deal where the father says, I'm giving you permission. That creates a position of trust.
And you don't think you can create it just by virtue of the fact that he's taking the child, right?
You can create
it. Even though the statute says specifically, however limited, however brief, and so forth.
Right. You can create it voluntarily, but under the specific language of Pellman, which I might be reading literally.
Well, Pellman had a different fact pattern.
Right. But the holding is the holding.
Well, Pellman just says that this easily qualifies to be under that language, you know, because of this and that and the other thing. I mean, all you're saying is the facts differ from Pellman here, so you win.
We're
construing the statutory language.
Well, yes, but nowhere in the statute does it say ongoing lengthy supervisory role. That's not in the statute.
That's just Pellman talking about the nature of the relationship.
In that case. But that modifies the voluntary assumption of a position of trust.
I think you're nearing the end.
I'm going to briefly address some of Judge Boris's dissent as quickly as I can here. I think being a landlord of 2 years doesn't create a continuous relationship of supervision of the child or responsibility for the child's welfare. Living 4 or 5 blocks away doesn't create a position of trust, because then all neighbors who live 4 or 5 blocks away would be in a position of trust, all neighbors you know. Other landlords are strictly business. Well, that doesn't create a position of trust because that's about other landlords. The boys help with chores, and I guess what I'd point out there is that there's no relationship created previously between the defendant and AB. And I would suggest that also suggests that all employers of teenage children are in positions of trust. And I think the Chamber of Commerce would have something to say about that, that employers are all in positions of trust regarding their employees when they're teenagers. So, I guess I'm going to wind up here because I have one extra minute. And so essentially what I'm saying.
You don't have one. It's overtime. But we'll let you finish.
Well, we just ask that the court either affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals or find that the petition was improvidently granted because it requires a special relationship more than what existed here.
Thank you, Mr. Willett.
Thank you for your time and your questions. They're very, very interesting.
Mr. Presby, if you want, you have 2 minutes and 13 seconds for rebuttal.
I'm just quickly going to point the court to page 5, and this is the printout of the case in the Court of Appeals. Says at the time the unlawful act occurred here, defendant as the landlord was charged with the responsibility of fixing the shower in the house. The record does not include any evidence that the victim's father charged the defendant with babysitting or otherwise supervising the children while he was fixing the shower. And there was no evidence the father gave permission to the victim to go anywhere with the defendant. That, in conjunction with the court's finding that there was insufficient evidence to support a position of trust because there was no specific permission given or any specific charge of babysitting, is the problem, is the language that the people have a problem with. When the defendant here said that the defendant had never cared for AB, and is one time enough, the first time they care for somebody, absolutely one time is enough. Because of the overall relationship between the defendant and this family, when he picked that child up, went into the house, picked her up, and took her off site, he was caring for and responsible for her supervision, and that is sufficient to meet the definition of position of trust as it's found in the statute. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I don't have anything else. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both of you for your oral arguments as well as your briefs. The case will be